Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today. Welcome back to the official Project Blue Book podcast. So it's felt like forever, right? Hasn't it? Everybody, y'all been waiting over this long hiatus, but hopefully you have spent that hiatus researching UFO lore and rewatching season one because Project Blue Book is hot out of the gates for season two, starting with the Roswell incident part one. And as we did with season one, we're always going to have an episode after every fresh History Channel Project Blue Book with our Project Blue Book official podcast. I'm your host, Tara Bennett, a senior producer for Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm beyond excited to open our podcast season with creator, executive producer, David O'Leary.
Hello.
Showrunner, executive producer, Sean Jablonski.
Hello.
And in the room with us together, a rarity, Dr. J. Allen Hynek himself, Aidan Gillen. Hello, sir.
Hello there.
And Captain Michael Quinn, Michael Malarkey. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back, guys. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks. Last time I was lying on my bedroom floor in Ireland.
A little bit of podcast insider knowledge.
No, it's good. I'm going to maybe lie on the floor here, too.
Once we get to episode
two. Do it.
Two,
get comfortable.
Okay, hang on a sec. I'll just get myself sorted.
So the great thing is you have a whole season under your belt. You decide to come back to season two with Roswell. No, like, hey, let's softly come back. Boom. Here we go. So tell me a little bit about what you kind of learned from season one, just in terms of you sat in that room before season one, picked the cases. What'd you do for season two that felt maybe even a little different?
At the end of season one, we leave Hynek and Quinn with they've made this pact.
Yes.
Like, they both know that there's more going on here. They're going to work together to figure out the truth wherever it takes us. We've also sort of left open this idea that there's sort of a secret history to this phenomenon. Right.
Right?
Like, Truman has left these sort of words, which was a real life quote that I'm blanking on right at this moment. But the only thing new in this world is the history you do not know,
yeah,
is I think what he says. And when Sean and I got together, you know, obviously Roswell is the granddaddy of the modern UFO cases. And it was a challenge in some ways, I think, just because it's 6 years later, right? We're in 1953 now. The events occurred in 1947. We're not about to pretend that they didn't. So we had to find an organic way where we could go back and explore the origin of this story and really the beginnings of the cover-up itself.
Right.
We hadn't quite done that before. I don't think we had done sort of a quote-unquote cold case, a case that was really after the fact. We hemmed and hawed until we came up with a very organic idea really based off of Roswell itself and what really happened there, which is that this was a town that went through something unbelievable, many witnesses, and then was silenced and intimidated into not speaking about it. And many witnesses were afraid to come forward, which is why it took so long for the real Roswell story to really come out. And could we use that to our advantage? Can you really ever silence the truth forever?
Mm-hmm.
What if there were cracks in that veneer? What if somebody had been able to hang on to evidence and was willing to talk? That felt like an organic way to bring our guys 6 years later back to events that had occurred. And then, of course, this opens up all kinds of exciting opportunities, becomes a bit of an origin story for General Harding, and gets our guys to go back to the beginning where it all began and start to unravel all of the secrets that are there.
In approach this season, too, when we looked at it, just sort of thematically, we came up with this notion of this year, the conspiracy is the case,
mm-hmm,
right? And so much about what the approach to the season was digging into the cover-up overall about UFOs and flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
And really, in the modern era, it started with Roswell. When we approached it that way, there was no other place to start but Roswell.
Aidan and Michael, were you guys surprised that they decided to go big and go with Roswell? Because that is one that you feel like maybe that's down the pike. Maybe they'll get to it eventually.
I'm not surprised, actually. I don't think anything
surprises you
in this
anymore.
World.
Yeah.
I was quite happy about it, actually. I thought it was a good idea to go for something that was as familiar to audiences as that, which wasn't something that was just rolled out straight away. Well, let's just try to hit the mass appeal or the mass recognition factor straight away. We waited 10 episodes to do
it.
That's pretty clever, actually.
actually.
Yeah.
And also the combination of kind of going back, you're also delving in with the characters in the same way. You're able to go back into who these characters are. It's a nice parallel for character building as well. But also, you know, this case, it was kind of closed, but at the same time, cases are never really closed a lot of the time. And I think it does a justice to a lot of the people that are still experiencing things and have to live with that. And we get to see one case where that's a reality.
Yeah, and that ties in exactly to what Quinn's going through, because we open it with basically him having a flashback to what happened in D.C., so he's still not even resolved.
It's also, it's kind of a defense mechanism to be able to do your job and to live your life. And it happens with a lot of people who have trauma in their lives, is that it becomes this thing that you have to bury deep down because mm-hmm. it's too either painful or too confusing and doesn't allow you to continue to operate. It's almost as a defense, this kind of trying to at least tell himself that it maybe wasn't what it was, so he can just carry on with his work. But, you know, we'll see how that pans out.
It's interesting that it's characters like the generals, Harding and Valentine, at this point. With this incident, the whole thing could have been, if this was resolved and explained in a satisfactory way, the whole thing could have been nipped in the bud right there and then.
Yes.
Right.
You know? It's not just the start of the phenomenon and the UFO story, which is continues to this day. You know, Roswell is a town which still lives off this myth. It's its main industry. But, you know, if they had have got what they wanted right there and then, the whole thing could have been...
It could have been put to bed.
Completely different story, yeah.
One of the books we used a lot for... And by the way, I love this deep morning voice I have.
Yeah, yeah, you're sounding,
I was like,
you're
I really,
sounding
I'm
good.
Like, I'm, I think I'm
Jablonski's
voiceover voice.
He gone deep. He went deep.
Was, I think the book was written when? In the 80s or 90s or something?
Witness to Roswell.
Yeah. And so that's 40 years after the fact.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most comprehensive source materials about the cover-up and what happened. And I think they launched it because all the people who were involved were getting too old.
That's
and
right.
passing on. So, and even now people are still investigating it and you're like one step removed. So it's never been resolved.
Anybody really interested in taking a deep, deep dive? I don't think we can recommend that book enough. I would listen to it on audiobook. Every day in the writer's room, I had like a 30-40 minute drive. It was just mind-blowing. Something for just the fans to know is that all the clues and bits and pieces that Heineck and Quinn discover on this two-part journey into Roswell are rooted in real-life witnesses and real-life events. Calling them back 6 years later became the mechanism by which we could then have them do a deep dive into what really happened here.
And it's unique because, as you said in the season one, we pretty much saw these two going out and actively trying to brush away all of the mystery in an existing, happening now kind of place. And so for them to have to dig through what people have covered up and what people have been told to keep down is really interesting. I wanted to ask Aidan and Michael, you guys have worked on series for a long time and come back for multiple seasons. That first year is always the most important in kind of figuring out how to live in the skin of your character. And so when you came back for this season, did you have a better sense of the character, your comfort zone in playing them, and then also about what you wanted to do a little bit differently with them this year to just, you know, take them in a different direction and open up some different pathways for who they are as people?
Yeah, I guess you're always trying to introduce different shades as you go, but nothing too radical. You know, I suppose the aim when you come back to playing a character is that when you shoot your first scene, it shouldn't look like, oh, here I am shooting my first scene again. It should just be you caught off guard in your everyday life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We know each other better, you know, the writers know us better.
Yeah.
That's always to be taken advantage of. I think my main aim was to always to remember to have some fun.
Yeah.
To show a lightness if possible.
You definitely see that between the two of you. There's a relaxedness aside from you guys also just letting them look like everyday citizens as they're doing this investigation. They're less formal, but they just feel like there's a confidence in what they're doing, even if there's still the questioning of what's going on. There's just this kind of lived in, relaxed feel of these two guys that certainly have a better sense of each other, even though they don't know the case.
And that's kind of come naturally. If you've done, you know, a season, 10 episodes already, and if it's been a success, and if we know people like it, a lot of your work is done. You know, first time around, you're trying to not just establish who you are as characters, but just find your way as performers into, you know, how do we do this? What's our best route into, you know, getting away with it?
Mm-hmm.
And once that's established, it's about just sitting back and, you know, if the words are good enough, all you have to do is say them.
Yeah, similar. I didn't really come in with a plan other than to, like, crush it as best as I could. But, You know, I believe in using the script to find that in a way. But if anything, I feel like what happened naturally is we start off season one. I feel like Quinn, throughout the season, had quite a front, you know.
Yeah.
And a kind of tough exterior, which you'd see some slight chinks in the armor here and there. But I feel like this season, because of the nature of their relationship and also with Susie and getting physically close with someone as well, you see a certain elements of him letting his guard down and different softer, sensitive sides to his persona. Mm-hmm. And also you see more, I think, what drives him and how much of his heart he actually does wear on his sleeve. As the season progresses, you see more of that.
One of the things, too, so the scene that plays now is the opening starting in D.C. and then coming into the Blue Book office was something that came after we had shot what was the original version of the opening.
Yep.
Where we opened in Quinn's apartment, which we'd never seen before, and it was a wonderful sort of back and forth. They were sort of debating theories about what we learned at the end of 110 last year, Antarctica, which
Antarctica
is coming up.
Yep.
But I missed that scene a lot because the interplay there, and there was like one little moment that was there with this little coaster where Nick goes to put his drink down and Quinn holds it up and puts a coaster down. There's just this cute little moment.
It leaves a mark of the wood.
It leaves a mark.
Right.
Otherwise.
Yeah. It leaves a mark on the wood.
And
respect
it was,
the wood.
There's a lipstick moment at the end where Hynek finds the lipstick and holds it up like,
So when Susie comes into the apartment
and looks at,
and
the,
looks at the lipstick,
yeah.
What originally was there was at the end of the scene that is no longer there. Quinn is on the phone. Hynek sees the lipstick under the couch and pulls it up.
That's right.
And has a moment of, whose is this?
Yeah,
and
who's
Quinn
this
just
lady?
Very, like, takes it away, sets it down on the table where Susie finds it later. So it was this little connection where Hynek already figured out something was going on.
Yes.
And then we give it away to the audience. So I do miss that, but it, to their point, it was like they came in already, like, it was so comfortable how they were with each other. It was great. I missed that scene.
Yeah. It was so comfortable that they just cut the scene.
Right. Well, you know, I think one of the reasons we also cut it. It was sort of two ideas at the same time, right? We're talking about Antarctica and we're talking about like all the stuff unseen has shown Hynek, and but then we're really pivoting into something else and into Roswell. And we knew that we were going to get there and we will get there with that stuff. We're not letting any of the stuff that's happened in season one go by any stretch.
We were checking boxes.
We were checking boxes.
Oh, we have to clear the decks before we can move the story forward. And you felt it. It was
The
story didn't start until we got to Roswell. And this way, at least it's, we start in character. We start in where Quinn is at.
We also got to shoot out of town for those first couple of episodes.
Yeah, we did. We shot up in Kamloops.
Yeah, which is, you know, it gives you a going away on camping, as I call it, gives you a whole different energy, I find. We shot in Kamloops, which is not too far from Vancouver.
It's about four hours.
And it's a very passable. We don't want to give the game away. Actually, we were in New Mexico.
Right in
the middle of Area 51.
Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of coming
first
back,
to film there.
And that was one of the things I remember is just when we got up there and you have Hynek and Quinn up on these ridges overlooking
desert
in the background. The show had never looked this way. We put Hynek in sunglasses as he's walking down the street, the main street of Roswell, and it felt like we were just opening up. We're just opening up new doors.
It
actually
give you a different energy or an extra boost of energy to be in a different place. I wasn't joking when I said that. It's like a proper surge of a new kind of energy. And people are always a little bit kind of giddy when they're away.
The crew had a blast. when we would wrap shooting on any given day, I mean, we were all staying at the same hotel. And
we'd go
downstairs and have a drink or two at the hotel
bar. You're essentially in the desert for 14 hours.
Yeah.
Like, what? Come on.
You'd have a discussion about, like, you know, how many snakes we caught that day, that kind
of
thing.
There was a snake wrangler on set.
No.
Yeah, snake wrangler with no snake anti-venom.
That's problematic.
Our director at one point picked up a snake, too. I remember, like, he was chasing a snake and he picked one up or something.
We were like,
no, don't get bitten.
It's funny, too, because season one had a lot of night sequences, and this was so bright. You added that beautiful sepia tone to it. It gave it that kind of broad scope and this daylight element of what you guys are doing rather than kind of poking around in the woods
in
and the
shadows,
crevices that you're just out there. And it's just as broad and expansive and problematic as
lucky.
A dark wood.
Yeah, we got lucky in that. Part of that was a function of when we shot. Because, like, in season one, we started shooting in December, and it was, like, super short days. Vancouver was wet and dark and spooky, and which I think was great.
Yes.
And we do some of that this season too, of course. But because we started shooting in July and it was the summer, it was, we didn't plan it that way, but it just was like, oh, wow, we're going to really get to shoot in the day. If anything, we were worried about, do we have enough time for night stuff?
Honestly, the night stuff was hard to shoot on because the night was so short that in order to do it, you couldn't start, I think, a night shot until what, like 9 or 10?
Yeah, 9 or 10 at night.
Yeah.
So it was like these late nights too.
Being able to have it in that environment, you have some great setups. Quinn's tackling guys off of motorcycles and headlocking them, and you've got the sniper from the ridge shot. You've got a lot of really big kind of action-y pieces in this first episode as well. Was there a favorite moment, Michael or Aiden, for you guys just to play? Because you're coming back, it's your first block, and like you said, feels new, and you get to just kind of play around in this environment where it's a nice mix of things.
Yeah, we shot a lot in a short time. I think there was a sequence where we were driving along in a Jeep, and this is simple.
Oh, yeah. On the
with a drone flying along beside us.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I remember feeling, you know, this is
dangerous.
Well, you also have cameramen. Yeah. You got like our camera guys like
hanging off the
Dowell hanging out the Jeep to try to get you guys in the shot. And I was
like,
man. Oh my God. They build these contraptions so that the cameraman can go almost like halfway in, halfway out of the. As I lean back, I'm like leaning back and you can't. Sorry.
But, he's playing it out for us very clearly in this room.
Special shout out to Daryl Hartwell, who's our camera operator.
Yes. I mean,
he's definitely the hardest working man on there.
Extraordinary.
He always looks like he's just about going into cardiac arrest. Which one he is.
Yeah.
Get that shot.
We're coming out of it,
But yeah, driving along in the Jeep with the drone flying along beside us down a valley floor in somewhere in New Mexico / Kamloops. Yeah. I don't know why it was that. It was just, it was being in that expanse, going at speed, knowing this is going to be a great shot. And, you know, in a sequence where I don't think we even had any dialogue. And it was one of the first things we shot. And it's nice to not be talking all the time. I like looking at people not talking.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Well, there's also that scene where we're driving and we are talking loads over each other where we're driving over the...
When you find the checkpoint.
100-something foot ridge drop. And I remember thinking at one point...
Yeah, you were driving. In reverse.
And I remember kind of looking over like, man...
Well, I have the series in my hands.
He really trusts me right now.
Yeah.
I'm a little nervous.
And he doesn't even have a license.
Yeah. But I love that stuff too, just because they're really driving. By the way it's shot, you can tell this isn't a green screen. You're bumping on
the
road with them. We're on the road with these guys. You just feel like you're in it.
Shout out to the sound mixers who actually kept the dialogue, because a lot of times you have to ADR dialogue replace that stuff. So a lot of times if you see people in a car or it's loud outside, in order to get it, you'll bring them back into a studio. They'll have to watch and match exactly what they were saying in a studio to what happened on the day. So you're recreating the performance, which everybody can kind of do it well, but it is a second performance of the same thing.
And it was the second performance I personally didn't want to do, because we did go back to the studio and we were asked to redo that, but it just didn't feel like it should happen. And, you know, when we shot that scene, which you're talking about, you know, it was a two shot.
Mm-hmm.
We were being encouraged to speak at the same time. Something I always like. I mean, you know, it's Robert Altman, I suppose, did it to an extreme in things like McCabe and Mrs. Miller and MASH, you know, where everyone's talking at the same time. But Spielberg did it quite a lot too in things like Jaws, you know, where everyone's talking at the same time. And Darren Serafian, who directed those first couple of episodes, is of that kind of old school. I mean, his father was a director, directed Vanishing Point.
To
And he's related to Altman also. You know, when a director gives you the go ahead to like just talk over each other, you know, I know a lot of people probably don't like that, but we like it.
Yeah.
Because it just means you can kind of fuck
up. I think it started
and it feels so natural.
Feels real. Yeah.
It started
real.
A nice precedent for us too, where we thought like, let's continue
see
a bit of
it
this
a lot
through
in the
season.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Alex Graves actually encouraged that towards the end of the last season in episodes 9 and 10. And, you know, as much as anything, it was about, we've got 90 seconds for this scene, so the only way we're going to do this is if you overlap.
Roll shock,
right.
And I suppose it's just realistic. And it's nice to be given the opportunity to be realistic. You think it's all, that's the idea, that it's all realistic, but it's all obviously artifice as well, you know?
Another thing when you come out of a first season of a show that has two paths that people can watch it. You can either just be mainstream and be, hey, I'm interested in this. I like the dynamic of these guys. Cool. These cases. Oh, they really come from real life. And then you've got people that have been watching all these documentaries, that read the books, that go to the conventions, that have these really deep dive conversations about these particular cases. When you come into a season 2, you go, okay, what lessons do I take just from some of the chatter and the feedback that we've gotten from season one that helped you either consider how you would tell your stories in season two, whether you leaned into something more, whether you took little pieces of feedback from fans and saying, hey, we'd love for you to be doing more of this, or even yourselves said, okay, well, we can take off the reins now because we've had a season. Let's do more of this.
It's a bit of a mixed bag, I think, mm-hmm. sometimes for me. You know, and we have the utmost respect for the phenomenon as it is, the UFO phenomenon, for the fans. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they own it as much as we do.
Yeah.
And so you want to have respect for that as well. And yet, at the same time, you have to feel like you can be creative and tell stories and be entertaining at the same time. And the only time I feel I ever get into trouble from a writing standpoint or a creative standpoint is when I feel like I'm trying to uphold other agendas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I'm working for other people. And I don't mean that I don't or we don't take in, because we take in a lot. We talk to the actors, we talk to the studio and the network and our producing partners, and you're always taking stuff in. And yet there's a moment at which you have to set that stuff aside and go, now we have to tell the story the way we need to tell it. And so it's like you basically take it in, forget it, and then, I don't mean like you forget it, you set it aside and do
yeah.
it. Yeah.
And then even the history becomes yet another voice. One of the things I always think that's great that we're on history is we do draw a very clear line in the sand between the entertaining show that we hope that we're telling and the facts, right? There's always those little segments, the 2-minute or 5-minute documentary piece after where you can learn more about the real life case. We always encourage people to, we're happy to share like, oh, this is where we found this information. And this is like where we picked up that. I mean, I have a million different UFO books I can recommend. But at the end of the day, we hope to like encourage the curiosity and the budding UFO researcher themselves to be inspired by the show. And if they want to learn more, there's so much more there. So
there's lots of little homages and little nods to things. And I think that's what keeps it kind of clever and cool. And it's like, look, if you do have knowledge about these things, you will be able to see this and go, oh, snap. I wonder if that's
referencing
that.
A favorite little Easter egg we have this season is if you look closely at the bottle of bourbon that people are drinking throughout. It's called Ruppelt Bourbon. Ed Ruppelt was the first director of Project Blue Book.
Oh, yes.
And that character is based on him.
That's
right. Based on him, yes.
So that's just something to know. And we have a few different Easter eggs like that that we try to throw in of just like nods to
don't
history.
Tell them, don't tell everyone what they all are or they won't be as much fun.
That's right.
That's true. That's true.
Be done. Yeah. I'll leave it there.
It's the keeper of the Easter eggs.
There
are others,
though. Definitely, if you look.
So I want to talk about Susie and Mimi before we wrap this up. Especially Aiden, you and Laura, basically for all of season one, had to kind of play a marriage that was working very separately. They were trying to navigate him being in Project Blue Book, how much that kept him away from home, that pushed Mimi into a friendship with Susie and created her own questions about who she wanted to be and what she wanted to do. But we start this first episode of the season with Alan making a little side call, and the person that's informing him is Mimi. And so we get to have you guys working in more accord, and that starts off and continues to push through the season with you guys. Now, in truth, as the real Hynix were working together, we start to see the first kernels of that.
Always fun to do something different, and that distance, you know, I don't know how typical or atypical or whatever it might have been of a 1950s marriage. Probably wasn't that unusual, that kind of distance. What you're talking about, that closer relationship, was actually hinted at in a latter episode in the first season, you know, where we did make a pact to actually share more information together or, you know, that I wasn't going to be so clandestine about my work, etc. But we do go straight into it in season two. And yeah, it's always interesting to change things up. And I want more to do with Laura Minnelle because, you know, she's great. And, you know, you don't want to be just meeting each other in the kitchen and saying, what are we having for dinner tonight?
TV dinner.
Actually, what are we having for dinner tonight?
Right.
And, you know, where we do see Laura, I was going to use the word, it's not infiltration at all. She becomes engaging with a civilian UFO group. Now, that's the whole thing that I found very interesting and one of the aspects of the whole story that I'm glad we're getting into, because these civilian UFO groups in the 1950s were considered a major threat and potential breeding ground, or, you know, something that was ripe for...
The government was concerned about these civilian UFO groups because one of the doctrines of these UFO groups is that your government is lying to you about UFOs, and these are just ordinary civilians. And so this wave of sort of distrust in the government started to spread, and it felt great to throw Mimi into those fires and just sort of a different side of the phenomenon, sort of how it impacted the sociological culture of the 1950s.
They were the original Russian bots.
Yeah.
Putting out fake news. Yeah.
Right.
That's how the government saw him, at least.
Yeah, so it was nice to have more to do and to have different stuff to do and for her to also go off on her own tangent. I keep saying this, but, you know, as closer as it might appear we are, we're also quite our own people and secretive in our ways that loving couples often are.
Like any marriage.
That's right.
Yes,
like any marriage. Like any
marriage. Truth in fiction.
Cultivate your own garden. Yeah.
And just in terms of Michael and Susie, Quinn doesn't open himself up very much. So were you playing it as just a casual dalliance, or is this something that might have the potential to pull him into something a little bit deeper?
I suppose it always starts out with the initial attraction, you know, with anybody. And I mean, he's obviously known who she is, knows she has a bit of a dark past.
Already.
And I think that's kind of hot to Quinn.
Yeah.
And so I think it initially starts with that, obviously. I mean, it's how my wife and I initially got together, so. but over time, I think he's kind of grown more and more sweet on her. But I think he also has this respect of letting her be herself and allowing a certain amount of distance, mostly because he kind of wants that himself too. You know, he wants to be able to still have his, because he also is, you know, he can't be too close to anybody really
with the job
anyway.
Yeah,
so it's a fine line there, but I think he definitely is sweet on her, and we'll see how that pans out.
So I will let that finish up where we are with this episode, because we will be able to talk in more detail, because this is a two-parter. But this is a really great way to start the season, guys. So thank you very much for laying the groundwork for how we're going to be moving forward with season two. Sean, David, Aiden, Michael, thank you very much for coming in and being able to start on such a high note. And as always, I want to thank my incredible returning podcast team, producer Kirby Dixon, producer editor Paul Terry, mixer master Dave Draper, Sci-Fi Wire Digital's Matt Romano, and our host for our recording sessions, LA Digital Recording. Thanks for having us, guys. And thank you guys at home for listening, however you listen to us, whatever podcasting system you listen to. Thanks for downloading us. Subscribe. Come along with the journey. All 10 episodes of this season. Let us know if you like it. Reviews are awesome because that just boosts Project Blue Book and it boosts the podcast. So give us a little shout out if you like us. And with that, we always remind you, watch the